This is Canopy with Alan Harrison and Andrew Marshall. Today on Canopy, we present an interview with John Livingston, professor of environmental studies at York University, as well as excerpts from a presentation by the Innu people of Nitassanan. But first, here's Andrew with the local news.
Members of the Guelph community traveled to Tomogmy Wilderness Area to protest logging this past weekend. Guelph residents joined other Ontarians and members of the Tamiagama Anishinaabe Indian Tribe and blocked the Red Squirrel logging road. The decision to begin the road blockade came from the Tamiagama Anishinaabe. The Tamiagama Anishinaabe have a native land claim on the wilderness area and are waiting for a Supreme Court of Canada ruling. The recent trip to the Tomogmy Wilderness Area is just one of the local events concerning the Tomogmy. On Wednesday, November 6th, a benefit for Tomogmy was held at Phil's grandson's place in Waterloo. The event was sponsored by Beating Drum Productions, Spotlight Magazine, and Phil's grandson's place. Had Guelph bands Steve and Steve and Dizzy Maroon, and all gate and bar proceeds went to the Tomogmy Wilderness Society. For those who missed the benefit for Tomogmy at Phil's grandson's place, here's a bit of Dizzy Maroon's song, Greenhouse Effect. For more information concerning the Tomogmy Wilderness Area, you can contact either the Ontario Public Interest Research Group at 1 Trent Lane in Guelph, or the Guelph International Resource Centre at 34 Essex Street in Guelph. Provincially, a recent environmental article in the London Free Press showed Canada has a long way to go in newspaper recycling. According to the article, only 3% of Canadian newspapers are printed on recycled stock. That means 20 million trees were cut to keep Canadian newspapers publishing last year. John Foy, president of the Canadian Daily Newspaper Publishers Association, admits the industry has been slow to embrace the use of recycled products, but feels Canadian newspapers will use more recycled newsprint as environmental awareness grows. John Foy says Ontario newspapers are getting involved in the second stage of the Ontario Multi-Material Recycling Program, which oversees Ontario's Blue Box curbside recycling program. Also in London, a recent London Free Press article addressed reasons for land developers destroying trees. Residents in London inquired why developers would destroy trees when trees replenish the Earth's atmosphere with moisture and oxygen. Alec Harrison, a developer and president of the London Home Builders Association, agrees some developers do not do enough to preserve trees on land they are developing. Harrison says most builders try to preserve trees because trees on a property make it much more attractive to buyers. However, Harrison also concedes that a trend to bigger homes and building homes closer together makes it difficult to save trees in the side yards of properties. Provincially, the 15th annual Kuching Conference was held this past August on the shores of Lake Kuching in Geneva Park, Ontario. The keynote speaker at this conference was John Livingston, a professor in environmental studies at York University. In his keynote address, John Livingston discussed the human impact on ecological destruction. Canopy has the following clip from John Livingston's speech.
Most tropical natural communities, whether they're forested or not, doesn't matter, simply cannot meet either the nature or the volume of demands made on them by current human numbers, let alone the future demand by increasing numbers, accelerating urbanization in the tropics, and anticipated industrialization in the Euro-American image or some facsimile thereof. Most tropical natural communities just can't take the sorts of agriculture that we've attempted to export to them, simple as that. Europe and North America, see, appeared to tolerate the pressures of industrialization for a surprisingly long time. The tropics will not be able to do that. Of course, Europe, and especially North America, did not and don't now have the population levels of lower latitudes. But let's not forget that they both have an enormous, stupendous population of machines over and above the people. And machines are just as insatiable as people and just as effluent producing. Just put it in short form for the sake of time, the tropics don't have either the soils or the climate to deliver the kinds of crops at the levels of production that are going to be demanded, and indeed are being demanded. And also, because of their intrinsic nature, the tropics cannot be expected to be able to tolerate the chemical additives on which northern agriculture has become totally and utterly dependent. A criterion that's widely used by ecologists to talk about natural communities is resilience. And by resilience, they mean the inherent ability of these communities to recover, not only from natural perturbations like the fires and hurricanes and floods and everything, and the elephants and the budworms, but also, at least by implication, to tolerate some degree, to come back from some degree of human excess in, let's say, forestry, maybe, or agriculture. Generally speaking, the most ecologically resilient terrestrial communities on Earth are, guess where, in the temperate regions, mid-latitude North America and Eurasia. So resilient are these environments that for centuries the effects of human abuses of the land went mostly unnoticed. And such is our perceptual apparatus and our ingenuity with it that when they were noticed, they were generally screened out of mind because there were always new places to open up. Yesterday it was the prairies, today it's Amazonia, tomorrow, whatever. Only in our own time, say, are the cumulative effects of our abuses beginning to appear, or more accurately, to be acknowledged now. See, even the rich and ecologically resilient North Temperate regions are now showing clear signs, aren't they, of their inability to accept us and our ways of doing things for much longer.
And now, over to Alan for the rest of the show.
And now, Jean-Francois Baudet speaks on behalf of the Innu people about a government study which has found that the impact of low-level military flights is insignificant. This excerpt is from an interview done last week as part of the cross-country tour by the Innu to inform Canadians of the effects of low-level flying.
Like, what happened is that there were some preliminary hearings two years ago, I think, in different communities, just, and they went to Innu communities also, But it was to decide how should that assessment be made, that these preliminary hearings. And then the contract was given by the Ministry of Defense to Lavalin, which is an engineering company, to do that assessment. One thing has to be known is that Lavalin is also online to get contract to construct the base, so they are very interested in not showing too much negative impact of this flag, because they want the money from the construction of the base. And then after Lavalin, and that's the report that just came out, that's Lavalin reports, then this report is given publicly, is given to the public, and then there will be a second tour of hearings, so to let all the people concerned give an answer to that report. And they have 90 days from the release of the report to give an answer to it. And so they go around again in all the, well, probably in Eastern Canada and all the new communities to receive answer to that report. And then Lavalin goes back with it, modify the report if necessary, and then goes back toward the government panel of expert, which has to decide if they accept or not the report. And so that's the, and that should all be finished by May. So that's what is happening now with that report.
So in light of the latest developments, do you think that there is any hope for the preservation of the lands and the Innu people's way of life on the Nitassanan?
Well, I would say it's a very, very long road, but I believe it's there.
Yeah, I wouldn't place my hope into that, any report from the government or anything. I think the hope is on the struggle of the Innu people, and I think also it lays somewhere in the self-determination of the Innu people, in some sense.
And finally, an article in the November 8th issue of the Globe and Mail reveals Japan's environmental aid programs are plagued with problems, despite large amounts of funding. Last year, Japanese aid amounted to $11.6 million. This year, Japanese aid will ride $12.3 million, making Japan the largest aid donor in the world. As Japan's aid increases, however, the management of this aid worsens. Yasuyuki Okamori tramps happily along hilly trail in a tract of second-growth rainforest in East Kalimantan. Now and then, he stops to point out a dipterocarp seedling or to pat the fan-like shape of a buttress root. Mr. Okamori, a specialist in forest ecology who works for the Japan International Cooperation Agency, moved to Kalimantan 2 years ago. Now he never wants to leave. "This is the most exciting work of my life," he said. "If they let me stay longer, I will." But in Japan, the East Kalimantan project has become a symbol of many of the things that are wrong with that country's ambitious foreign aid program. The Japanese government originally meant to simply hand over to the Indonesian government the $15 million research and training center designed as an addition to Woolamorman University in Samarinda. But after the buildings were completed, the Indonesian government found it could not afford to staff the center with researchers. It stood empty for 5 years until an embarrassed Japanese government decided to send its own researchers. This summer, Japanese reporters visiting the center found tens of thousands of dollars worth of unused equipment, locked labs, and only a handful of Japanese and Indonesian scientists at work. An expensive computer system had to be returned to Japan because there was no local servicing available. A new system, bought in Jakarta, is still under wraps because no one knows how to run it. Even so, a government team that reviewed the program last July decided to extend it another 5 years. The decision was made just before the Paris Economic Summit, and was part of a $2.5 billion environmental aid program Japan announced there. As Japan's aid program goes, so does the possibility of failure. In the past, there was never much attention paid to the staffing or management, because most aid was in the form of industrial loans. As a result, the government is unable to follow its own standards for managing or evaluating projects. But progress is being made despite these growing pains. Japan once had trouble finding people willing to be stationed abroad. Now younger aid workers are finding the world outside Japan a thrilling place.
That's Canopy for this week. Join us again 2 weeks from today, November 28th, for these and other forest issues. If you have any comments or questions concerning today's show, or would like more information, you can contact us at CFRU at 824-4120, extension 6919. Special thanks to the staff at CFRU for their help. Canopy is produced by myself, Andrew Marshall, along with Alan Harrison.